Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you to our program this evening, entitled Understanding America's Terrorist Crisis, What Should Be Done? Our program features world-renowned author and man of letters Gore Vidal, and is co-sponsored by Harper's Magazine. For those of you who have not seen his new book, Gore Vidal is the author of Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, How We Got to Be So Hated. The Independent Institute regularly sponsors the Independent Policy Forum, a series of lectures, seminars, and debates held here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and featuring outstanding authors, scholars, and policy experts to address major social and economic issues. After 9/11, for example, we began a program to examine key issues involved in the terrorist war, and our program this evening continues this dialogue. As a result, we seek to get beyond left and right and feature speakers who present their own views so that we have a better opportunity to sift through and make up our own minds. For those of you new to the Independent Institute, you can find information in the printed program that hopefully everyone got. To provide some background, the Independent Institute is a nonprofit public policy research organization. The Institute sponsors comprehensive studies of major issues. The resulting studies are published as books and other publications and form the basis of numerous conference and media programs. You're all invited to visit our website at independent.org for further information on Institute membership and other programs, including our quarterly journal, which is called the Independent Review. This is the current issue, and the cover article is on the issue of the destruction of medical privacy in the United States. In addition, many of you may be interested in receiving our free weekly email newsletter called The Lighthouse, which critically examines current issues and reports on upcoming Institute events, publications, and other programs. In the next few weeks, we'll also unveil our newest website, which is called onpower.org, where you'll find many studies and other resources pertaining to the issues that are going to be discussed this evening. Could the tragedy of September 11th be setting in motion a chain of events even more ominous than the attacks themselves? After retaliating against the Al-Qaeda network and the Taliban, the Bush administration speaks of bringing justice to an axis of evil countries not involved in the 9/11 attacks, all while Osama bin Laden and company have escaped. Afghanistan has been bombed into near rubble. Countless civilians have been killed, and millions of Afghans live in refugee camps. Meanwhile, the Middle East teeters on the brink of a major war, as innocent Israelis and Pakistan and Palestinians continue to be killed. World leaders view U.S. military intervention with increasing alarm, and international opinion indicates that the U.S. government is more hated than ever. Could U.S. policies be provoking this hatred and the threats to the safety of Americans and people around the world? And if so, how can we produce a safer world? On the domestic front, Congress has passed a feeding frenzy of corporate welfare, pork measures, and attacks on civil liberties as special interest groups stampede to profit from the current crisis. For example, the new U.S. Patriot Act authorizes police and intelligence agencies to spy on any American. The act was passed by Congress before it was even completely written, meaning, of course, that no one had read it when it was passed. Fearful of being labeled unpatriotic, the Senate passed the act with only one dissenting voice. Compounding the absence of political debate, government officials have intimidated those in the public who've tried to raise questions. Hence, there's been virtually no public debate. In effect, officialdom apparently believes that the public should not be allowed to discuss these measures, to know what's really going on, or to question government authority. As a result, Washington unilaterally declares that the new terrorist war must be a global war without end. with no clear objectives, no enemy to be found who is clearly existing, no specified geographical area, and no clear strategy. The enemy is not on some front, does not have invading armies, navies, and air forces, and since we are now all under government surveillance, apparently it could be any of us. James Madison, the master builder of the U.S. Constitution, noted in 1795, quote, "Of all the enemies of public liberty, war is, perhaps, the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies, debts, and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the dominion of the few. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare," unquote. This evening we seek to facilitate a discussion of why terrorism now threatens America and what should be done. So I'd like to welcome our participants, and you can find further information on each in your program. Please hold your applause until I complete the introductions. Gore Vidal is hailed as one of the most remarkable cultural and political critics of our time. Born at West Point, raised in the Washington, D.C. home of his grandfather, Oklahoma Senator Thomas Gore, he is a cousin of Al Gore and was brother-in-law to John F. Kennedy. He has penned 22 novels, 5 plays, many screenplays and television scripts, more than 200 essays, and a memoir. His American Chronicle series of novels covers the entire history of the United States, beginning with the book Burr and ending with Washington, D.C. His nonfiction essays have been collected in 8 volumes, and his latest book, Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, that I mentioned earlier, investigates the terrorist crisis. We are also pleased to have moderating our program this evening the San Francisco native, Lewis Lapham. In 1975, Mr. Lapham became editor of Harper's Magazine, one of the most distinguished magazines in American history. The author of many books, he received the National Magazine Award for his column Notebook, is the host and author of the PBS series America's Century, and he was host and executive producer of the weekly PBS program Bookmark. Our panel of scholars this evening includes Barton Bernstein, who is on your left, who is professor of history at Stanford University. He received his PhD in history from Harvard University. He is a recipient of 2 Kunst Prizes, the Goldstein Prize and the Johnson Prize. Professor Bernstein is a world-renowned expert on U.S. foreign policy, the arms race, U.S. science policy, and weaponry. Next to him, Robert Higgs, a senior fellow in political economy at the Independent Institute and editor of the Independent Review, which I mentioned earlier. He received his PhD in economics from Johns Hopkins University, and he has taught at the University of Washington, Lafayette College, and Seattle University. Among his books, his widely acclaimed one called Crisis and Leviathan shows how war crises are used by interest groups to cartelize economies. The result is all manner of pork, corporate welfare, the trampling of civil liberties, and other repression. And rounding our panel, Thomas Moore is senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He received his PhD in economics from the University of Chicago and has taught at Michigan State University, the Carnegie Institute of Technology, and UCLA. Dr. Moore served as a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors and the President's National Critical Materials Council, for which he served as chairman. Please join me in welcoming our participants. A couple of quick program format matters before we begin. After the discussion, we will have questions from the audience. In with the printed program, you should have received a question card. If you have a question, please simply jot it down on the card, and there'll be ushers circulating down the aisles in the main theater and also upstairs in the green room to pick them up. Please also keep your question to the subject matter of tonight's program. After the question period, we will adjourn, and Mr. Vidal will then be available in the outer lobby to autograph his book. And because of the numbers of people here tonight, we ask that there just be one autograph book per person. It will not be possible for people to stop and chat because it will just prevent others from getting their autograph. So at this point, I am very pleased to pass the baton to Lewis Lapham.
Thank you. Gore, I count it both a honor and a pleasure to talk to you on these subjects. And I gather from reading Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace that you would think that we are more threatened at this point by, not by the terrorists, who may or may not be where we think they are, but by the mullahs in Washington. Is that fair?
I think that they are a clear and present danger. And we must be on guard against the Enron Pentagon junta that governs us so idly. You were talking earlier about who was the most surprised by 9/11. I had figured out some time ago, and one of the reasons that I have this little list in the book of unilateral strikes that we have made against second and third world countries, over 200 of them since 1949-50. And sooner or later, somebody was going to get irritable. I mean, it's bound to happen. The first law of physics is there is no action without reaction. Our rulers seem to be blithely unaware of this. They can do anything they like, and people can go lumping. I was betting not so much on a Muslim strike as a Panamanian one. The fury of Panama when we seized their ruler, Noriega, which automatically ended all drugs in America. Have you noticed that since then? George Bush Sr. did that for us because he cares. And we got another one. I would also like to thank in passing Brother Thoreau, who has taken my James Madison quotation that I was going to begin with. People who belong to foundations stop at nothing. It has to do with that Rolodex. I don't know the sense of power it gives them. That was my Madison quote. And I don't share these too kindly. Anyway, in answer to your question, yes or no, as the case may be.
Yes or no. But the... In whose... We have a war on terrorism, which is a war both on an unknown enemy and an abstract noun. Therefore, it's a war with no end, and it's a war that cannot be won. And it bears a resemblance to the war on drugs for the same reason. And the question then is, in whose interest are these wars?
Well, corporate America is the usual explanation. And I dare say that it is good for business. We were entering a bit of a depression at the time of 9/11. So if it was Osama's timing, it was very clever to hit us when we were really quite off balance. But these presidents, as they go, get worse and worse, proving that Darwin was wrong. I'm a born-again creationist with the last 10 presidents. As the presidents get sillier and more reckless, the wars get more surreal. We are fighting we blew up Afghanistan when all of our enemies who struck at us in the airplanes that day were Saudi Arabians. They aren't Afghans. And the Afghans were rather hurt that we were blowing up all their cities when we should have been taking out Riyadh and the Saudi royal family and perhaps the rest of the family of Osama. So we hit the wrong people. Now, part of it is interesting that you've got a president that everyone knows he knows nothing. I mean, there is not an idiot anywhere in our spacious plains who doesn't know that he's nothing much is going on. And he's given things to read. When he has to mention a country, you know he hasn't heard of it. I mean, when he got to his little war dance before Congress with Iran and Iraq and North Korea, I mean, now, wait a minute. Then you realize he doesn't know what an axis is. Obviously, he hadn't spent too much time on the farm down there in Texas. So you get, everything becomes sort of blurred. Now, the sinister side is the speed with which Clinton, after Oklahoma City, which I deal with in the little book, was ready with an anti-terrorist act. Speed of light with the most venomous dialogue, condemning the terrorism of McVeigh and of the so-called Patriot Movement across the country. Then, of course, they decided immediately various of our freedoms were diminished, Fourth Amendment specifically. And I was startled how fast he was with it. Now we have the USA Patriot Act, which was passed, I think it was the 20th of October after the infamous September 11th. Congress passed it and, as is their wont, didn't read it. I don't know what feeling they have against it. Maybe they don't take it seriously. But that was a terrific piece of legislation, reminiscent of one of my favorite emperors, Tiberius. He was actually rather a good scout and certainly very bright. And Tiberius, when he became emperor, the Senate, in a cringing moment, sent him some legislation saying that they would accept in advance, sight unseen, any legislation that he wanted to send up to the Senate of Rome. And he sent back a message, and he said, you've lost your senses. Suppose the emperor has gone mad. Suppose the emperor is a raging enemy of Rome, and you didn't know it. You can't do that in advance. And they sent it back to him again. Anything, glorious Caesar, that you send us, we will endure it. And he said, and I feel myself wanting to repeat Tiberius's words, how eager they are to be slaves.
Why is there so little opposition in Congress? I mean,
look who came for them.
Yes, well, okay, so we're back to the buying the best Congress money can buy. And the same, would you say the same was true of the news media? By and large, the news media makes no objection.
No, it's the same ownership, those who own the Congresses and the presidents, own the media. And it's all just, everybody's working together.
When you say that the succession of the last 10 presidents has gotten steadily worse, I think I agree with you, but I don't know as much American history as you do. So prior to what, other than the founders of the country, I mean, is there a real change, let's say, since the Second World War, since 1945, 1947, when we begin to build the national security state?
Well, that was the great change, and it was an act, it was enacted by Congress, the National Security Act. It was 48 or 49. By 1950, Harry Truman gave us a militarized economy, and we were It was Charles E. Wilson, who was an important honcho then, who said, why is it we're always taken surprise by Pearl Harbors and so on? Why don't we just stay armed all the time? So we don't have to rearm ever. We're just constantly armed. Every now and then a genius idea does bowl up from General Electric. And that was the genius idea. We have been at war, really, ever since 1950. And the list that I have kept my piece from being published in Vanity Fair, and even the nation wouldn't take it. They couldn't face this list of places that we had struck at, like gallant little Panama, which was close to my heart, as you can see, and I worry about Panama. We have been like a rogue elephant going around the world, attacking this country and that country. And it was used to be because they were going to go communist. Many of them hadn't even thought of it. But we would always find a communist somewhere, and we'd send in the troops. Finally, Ronald Reagan's greatest moment was invasion of Grenada. And after, you know, it was full of Cuban communists. Well, it didn't appear to be any of them there, but it was Alexander Haig. Remember him? I miss some of these guys. Haig gave the game away when he said about Grenada as a military operation. He said the province town fire department could have done that invasion rather better than we did. So we have this perpetual war for perpetual peace, and it does a lot of damage in the world. It certainly damages other people's view of us. But it has given an opportunity to those who do not like our Bill of Rights and those freedoms that we used to enjoy and are being curtailed. They could always talk about, oh, FDR shot some Nazis that he found on a beach in the Gulf, and Truman and FDR locked up the Japanese and concentration camps, and Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus and so on. Well, these, however, were real wars. This is not a war. Because Junior says it's a war does not make it one. Because nobody has told him a war is between two countries. A country has an army, a navy, an air force, and a capital city, too. And they make stamps. I mean, how I'd like to advise him for a week, you know.
But I also think, I don't think we've had a war since, I know we're in a perpetual state of war, and I know that that's the way the economy works, and that's why we spend so much money on the Pentagon. But since the Vietnam War, where we lost 57,000 killed, since then, unless I'm wrong, I don't think we've lost more than 1,000 casualties in all of the productions in Panama, Grenada, the Gulf, and so on in the last 25 years, because I think that the Pentagon is now in the movie business. They have the notion that American soldiers cannot go into what they call non-permissive environments. And therefore, we stage colorful explosions in picturesque locations. And present them as advertisements for the wonders of democracy.
Well, they had to give up conscription after Vietnam because everybody was going to Canada or into the ministry.
Or shooting their officers.
Yeah, and fragging the officer. Yeah. I served 3 years in the Second World War, and it wouldn't have occurred to any of us to go through the shenanigans that Bush and Cheney went through to stay out of the Vietnam War, one in the Texas Air Force and the other one in an undisclosed area somewhere, which proved not to be Vietnam. But I think we believe more strongly in the country and in our virtue than these people. These people are, for the most part, rip-off artists. Notice that they're all gas and oil men, from Cheney to the two Bushes, I think Rumsfeld also. And what this is really about is oil. And it's Central Asian oil, which is what we've got our eye on. We do have practical motives every now and then. It is not just for sheer glory that we get into a war like the Afghanistan. Afghanistan is the entranceway to Central Asia and five republics that used to belong to the Soviet Union that are now the largest suppliers of gas and natural gas and oil. He who gets his hands on that will really control the world for a while. Henry Adams, who was something of a geopolitician, and his brother Brooks Adams, had worked out that he who controls Shanxi province in China, northern China, would control the earth because it had the most metal, most iron ore, and coal, which they used in those days. And so our whole business in the Philippines, in which Teddy Roosevelt went along with the Adams brothers, was to get our foothold on the mainland of Asia. So we get the Philippines from the Spanish. We don't let them set up their own country, which they wanted to do. And we become a great Asiatic power, and we end up being emperor of Japan, which was good going, but we never got Shanxi province. Now we have a second big chance, which is forgetting about Persian oil, which is getting too dicey, and going to Caspian oil. And that is the background to it, and I've got a very nice story here from a surprising source, a quotation from a newspaper. I will appear to be currying favor, as the paper is your own chronicle. And I said this is when I was going to start with James Madison. So you see, I've been
before
ruined.
David stole it.
Before he stole it, throwing me totally off key. And I said, yet the simple reasons behind the various provocations that led to the attack of 9/11 was precisely stated 2 weeks after the attack by your own San Francisco Chronicle, where Frank Viviano wrote, quote, "The hidden stakes in the war against terrorism can be summed up in a single word, oil. The map of terrorist sanctuaries and targets in the Middle East and Central Asia is also, to an extraordinary degree, a map of the world's principal energy sources in the 21st century," end quote. That is what it is all about. So you see, you need never stray from the Bay Area if you want to know more than the editors of Time and the Washington Post. It also helps that a major player in the secret war for Caspian oil just happens to hang out in this area, UNOCAL.
Why, if when the war is presented to us as a godly endeavor, I mean, we that kind of geopolitical realpolitik is not what is presented to the American public. I mean, we're doing God's work, presumably. I mean, even it goes back to Woodrow Wilson, who it's never clear whether he thinks that America is a religion or a state. And
religion, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, he invades Mexico to teach the Latin Americans to elect good men. Teddy Roosevelt takes Panama because it's a mission of collective civilization, and so forth and so on. What is that about, Gore? I mean, why? I mean, and we have the same thing with Bush. I mean, Bush, it's Holy Crusade. It's.
Well, that is an inheritance of our original Anglo-Saxon forebears. And the British Isles, I think probably over the centuries, have produced more interesting, even amusing hypocrisy than any other nation on earth. And we are the heirs of the tradition. We can't stop lying about motivations. And it's just as second nature to us to steal money and say it's for your own good. You just spend it stupidly.
But do you think the, again, you get this, our friends in Washington would tell us that the imperial mission has the full faith and backing of the American public, and I don't think that's true.
Of course it doesn't. My God, if we've... Every generation of Americans, including mine, had to be dragged into wars.
Yeah.
Second World War, 80% of the American people did not want to go back to Europe to fight, having been sold a lemon in 1917. Hence FDR's series of provocations, and this is not, I am a New Dealer, so this is not right-wing guff. Roosevelt provoked the Japanese into attacking us. The whole story is very clear now. It's all come to light. And he did it. Now, people say, oh, he's awful. He couldn't have done that. You must hate him to say that. I said, no, I admire him. If that was the only way to defeat Hitler, well, provoke them so that they will strike us at Pearl Harbor. He'd been reelected in 1940. No sons of yours will ever serve in foreign wars in any administration of mine. He stuck with that. He would like to attack the Germans, he'd like to attack the Japanese, but he doesn't dare. So he provokes them into attacking us. This is Machiavelli on such a grand scale. I feel mean repeating something about a noble American president who ought to be on Mount Rushmore. And he ought to. But sometimes there are provocations that are necessary in a historic process. Hitler, we all agreed, was pretty bad. This doesn't often happen that you have somebody who's that bad. So Roosevelt was on strong moral ground, although very weak constitutional ground. But we've had less worthy wars since.
But I have read the reports in Washington, and they airily say that the American people would gladly accept 30,000 casualties during the invasion of Iraq. I don't believe that.
As long as it's somebody else being killed, they don't mind that as much as if they might be put at risk. But when we gave up the draft after Vietnam, and it's a mercenary army, basically. And one of the conditions is no member of Air Force, Army, Navy is to be hurt. And this is difficult to do, but one result is the Air Force planes fly at 35,000 feet.
Yeah.
Where you can't see anything. That's why, you know, orphanages and schools are the targets of choice. Whereas military supply centers might not be so easy to get at. No, it's a weird world. A mercenary army that is not to be hurt, blowing up innocent countries, relatively innocent, like Afghanistan. What we did, I'd like to remark about having turned over our military to show business. There was a stroke of genius, and I don't think anybody thought it out, but we lost the war very badly in Vietnam. And we lost a lot at home, too. Then it was redressed. They made Rambo with Sylvester Stallone. And we won it on the screen.
Oh, yeah.
And that's all anybody remembers, is Stallone winning the war in the jungle.
That's right. We won it. Well, we now have the same thing. In Afghanistan, ABC News is denied entrance, is not invited to the battleground or even close to it. On the other hand, ABC, which is owned by Disney, has made a deal with Jerry Bruckheimer, who is the producer of Gladiator and Black Hawk Down and Top Gun. And Bruckheimer, in conjunction with the Pentagon, will make a 14-part series, documentary series, on the war in Afghanistan, and that is what will be presented on ABC as news. So it's a fairy tale. I mean, it's the equivalent of the Fellowship of the Rings. And as I say, we've been able to do this for 20 years with very few of our own people getting killed, at the same time producing enormous sums of money for the defense contractors and the various law enforcement agencies. I mean, in your book, you talk about McVeigh, and I think in a very interesting way. It's the most interesting commentary on McVeigh I've seen. And you make the point that McVeigh declared war on a government that he felt had declared war on its own people. I gather you share some of that sentiment. I mean, I don't endorse McVeigh's action, but I mean, I'm saying that. But do you think that the American government has declared war on the American people?
Well, the Branch Davidians at Waco had the impression that when they were being destroyed by Bradley tanks and.
But it's also the constant, which you talk about here again, and the constant subversion of the civil liberties, the shredding of the Fourth Amendment, the seizing of private property, that the Patriot Act allows the government to tap anybody's phone, open anybody's mail.
Well, I also have a long list of freedoms lost, written about 5 or 6 years ago in Vanity Fair, and how in big agriculture has deliberately driven small farmers out of business so that they can have these vast conglomerates. And the ex-farmers turned into Timothy McVeighs. Some of them are crazier than others, and some of them are sadder than others. And an awful lot of them end up the way, as he did, as a sharpshooter in the army. That's the only thing open to them, because they've lost agriculture, unless they want to work as peasants for agribusiness. That's one of the reasons no one has seen a decent ham sandwich since the Second World War. They keep those hogs, they don't move for their entire life. Because they don't move, they can't work off diseases and so on, so they're pumped full of penicillin or whatever is the antibiotic of choice. So we're eating what looks like gelatin, and finally is old penicillin.
You have, again in this book, you have a quotation from Justice Brandeis, which is a very powerful quotation, which I'm going to read and then ask you to remark upon. He says, "Our government is the potent, the omnipresent teacher. For good or ill, it teaches the whole people by its example. Crime is contagious. If the government becomes the lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for laws. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. The lawless government invites anarchy. To declare that in the administration of the criminal law, the end justifies the means. To declare that the government may commit crimes in order to secure the conviction of a private criminal would bring terrible retribution." Do you see?
Indeed I do, and this is what made me interested in Timothy McVeigh. I read this, and he said, he quoted this after he'd been condemned to death. He hadn't spoken during his trial. And they said, "Do you have anything to say?" And he said, "Yes, I'd like to quote Justice Brandeis's dissent in Olmstead." And he didn't do all of that much, but he did about half of it. And I was very intrigued. I was quite aware of how the government, what they had done at Waco and also at Ruby Ridge. He had followed all that, and he decided that he would strike a blow at them. Well, I understood why he wanted to do it. I did not approve, obviously, of what he did. I mean, there are other ways of getting back at a government that you realize that you believe to be tyrannous and the enemy of the people at large. He wrote a marvelous piece, which he got published just before he died, was killed, and it was about the deliberate militarization of the police, starting with the FBI. He said, "You know," he said, "I'm a professional soldier." He got the Bronze Star for bravery in the Persian Gulf. He said, "I am taught to kill, and that's my job, and that's a soldier's job. Policemen are not military men, they are civilians, and their task is to protect the life and property of other civilians from misadventure or whatever." He said, "Once you start giving them tanks and SWAT teams and so on, you are destroying the military, and you're creating a machine that may not be controllable. So he was, they should have kept him alive a bit longer, because first he might have said who the people were who helped him. There's even, I hate to have to say this, but there's an Iraqi connection in Oklahoma City. Well, I don't believe it, but anyway, the FBI seems to think there may be one, but they wouldn't follow up. They did absolutely no investigation. They wanted one lone, crazed killer like Lee Harvey Oswald. McVeigh could not have made that bomb. He didn't have the expertise. And he probably could not have driven that Ryder truck from Kansas to Oklahoma City without blowing himself up. It's a highly volatile mixture he had. Others were involved.
Go back to the point about the government being the teacher, for good or for ill. What kind of lesson do you think it is teaching us?
Government today?
Yeah.
You can do anything you want if you have force.
So that's the same lesson learned by the terrorists on September 11th.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I'm just allowed to continue. That's all that note.
Oh. No drama?
No drama. No threat any place outside.
We're at the second act curtain. You've got to have something happen.
But again, I mean, we have the... So our government has also taught the lesson of terrorism.
This long list that I've got, I mean, the IRS seizing people's property, ruining their businesses, attaching their bank accounts and not telling them, so you write a check and it bounces and you lose your business, your credit. Case after case after case of government running amok and nobody doing anything about it. Congress just sits there and deals in pork and raises money through bribes. That's all that corporate money is, to make sure that they don't pay taxes at these corporations. And few of them pay tax, and it's all legal because Congress has passed special legislation at the dark of the moon so that they'll be exempted. And the 1 year ITT on several billion dollars of profits in the United States paid no tax, income tax. It was all legal. It's been fixed.
So what kind of country have we become, or are we becoming? I mean, you are a man who writes lovingly about the American Republic, but that is no longer with us.
No, there's a sense of Asuncion in the air in Washington. Paraguay is near. We are not what we were, but that goes without saying. That's probably the lament in every generation. But it is much more visible now. And to me, the moment that really tore it was November 2000, that when we allowed that election to be stolen by the Supreme Court. A serious country would have been marching in the streets. But we aren't serious anymore. We don't care. So, thanks to Almighty God and Rehnquist, Scalia and Thomas, Sandra Day O'Connor and Kennedy, we have been given this president whom we did not vote for. And I had great fun with the New York Times story trying to justify the recount in Florida. You remember the Treasurer's Report by Robert Benchley years ago? And he plays this treasurer of a company, and he's got all the charts.
Right.
You know, everything is falling off the chart. And then you realize that he's got it upside down. And so these profits are not actually profits. They were, Enron. I've added a later joke to that, but anyway.
No, that is what happened.
That is what happens. And how do you restore a country which I have often referred to as the United States of Amnesia, in which there is no collective memory of anything before last Monday.
Yeah.
It just, and watching television now, it's so silly. I mean, they come on and shout and they yell, and you can't remember anything you saw 5 minutes later.
You're
That's
not
merciful.
Oh, they have to get on to the next commercial.
Well, that's the name of the game.
But is there any, do you have any hope for restoration, as you say, or you think that's impossible? Certainly there's not
Where
much
would it come from?
Yeah,
let's say you had a great charismatic leader who really could sort of pull things together, kind of less shady Huey Long type. He was pretty good. I remember him. It was a great joy. And Roosevelt was scared to death of him. He felt that he could defeat him. But then he was mysteriously killed, which often happens to our would-be saviors. If you had such a figure, he couldn't get on network television. So nobody would know about him. New York Times would not give him a good review. They wouldn't write about him.
Yeah.
So he would be just locked off with a vegetarian candidate, you know. And there goes Thomas Jefferson, our last attempt.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was an indication of that with the way the media treated the Nader campaign. Nader was regarded as a madman and a spoiler and so forth. And the Times, you know, at the beginning, when they thought he might conceivably be dangerous, they...
Watch what they did to Jesse Jackson, you know, in 88. He was a highly viable contender.
Yeah.
And they smeared him.
So you're right. I don't think they would get on television.
No. And it's not as though we have great riches, humanly, on television.
No.
At the moment. There is room.
So what do we do, is the point.
Pray.
But to whom? I mean, not to...
You pick yours, I pick mine.
I mean, then we get to the position of Ashcroft. We now have an attorney general in the United... Our attorney general is on record recently, as last February in Nashville, talking to 6,000 religious broadcasters and explaining to them that our freedoms do not come to us from human hands. Not a document, not a Declaration of Independence. Our freedom is given to us by God. And he has also explains when he goes around to speak at universities that the United States has only one king, and that king is Jesus. And this is the Attorney General of the United States.
Well?
And he's also on record as saying that the only verdict that he is interested in is the verdict of eternity, not history.
That's very good, yeah, well.
But he is...
He's not getting
either. He is close in spirit to the disciples of Osama bin Laden, I would think.
Well, I'd think very like. I think they understand each other. I've got a wonderful quote from Time magazine, which is incredible, but it's very Ashcroftian. This was right after 9/11. A guy called, do you know Lance Morrow?
Yeah.
I see the name every now and then and avoid the work, but this time I couldn't put him down. It's something I never thought I'd see in an American paper. And if I can't find it, I won't see it again. Here we go. Now, this is a full-page think piece by Mr. Morrow. For once, let's have no fatuous rhetoric about healing. Healing is inappropriate now and dangerous. There will be time later for tears of sorrow. I always like to get the word time in anything in Time magazine. A day cannot live in infamy without the nourishment of rage. Let's have rage. What's needed is a unified, unifying Pearl Harbor sort of purple American fury. A ruthless indignation that doesn't leak away in a week or two. Let America explore the rich reciprocal possibilities of the fatwa. A policy of focused brutality does not come easily to a self-conscious, self-indulgent, contradictory, diverse, humane nation. America needs to relearn why human nature has equipped us all with a weapon called hatred.
That's extraordinary.
I mean, you know, Goebbels never pulled it off that well.
When was that? Oh, you told me, right?
That was right after. Yeah. A week or so after 9/11. Not helpful for our peculiar situation in history.
Well, perhaps I can turn to the panel, and they will
lead us.
They will show us a way out, right? Because we have been reduced to prayer over here. Yeah. So maybe Barton Bernstein can offer us a more secular notion.